We're back on the TV Talk Machine podcast. It's episode 9. I'm Jason Snell, your co-host, and with me, as always, your host from The Hollywood Reporter, the TV critic, the chief TV critic, it's Tim Goodman. Hi, Tim.
Jason, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm very chiefly. I'm doing
chiefly. You're chief, the chieftain of that.
But chieftain sounds kind of like maybe a little bit vicious, like I might
you could
be
attack,
bringing down my reign.
You could attack movie critics at The Hollywood Reporter.
God, I would love to.
Just, yeah, you've got your army, and you just march in there and say, hand over the popcorn.
Yeah. I'm a chieftain. I'm going to get used to that.
Hi, chieftain.
All right.
I may be the only person who calls you chief TV critic, right?
I demand that.
All right. Okay, good. Good.
And then everybody, like, you know, people need to call me chief. Hey, chief.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
And then you
that.
Can say, don't call me chief, just like in like Perry White in Superman.
Exactly.
That's a deep
That's what I do.
Comic book reference there.
I do make people say, oh, you're the TV critic at the Hollywood Reporter. I'm like, no. Buddy.
Chief.
I'm the chief.
I guess read that way, what it means is there are other TV critics there, but, you know, it's primarily you.
There wasn't when I first started. Now there's like a, well, we have like a freelancer, and then we have every now and then we farm out a couple of stuff that I don't want to do.
Huh?
In fact, one of the things I don't want to do is the finale of Sons of Anarchy.
I hear like half of the fans are like, oh, I love Sons of Anarchy, and the other half are like, I'm just riding it to the end, you know?
Yep. See, I have the luxury of not writing it to the end, of making the decision to pull out. I mean, it was tough. I used to love that series, and I was a huge supporter of it. But, yeah,
this
a couple
is what,
of seasons ago, I just bailed. There was no one that I liked in the show.
This is what my wife always calls the "is that show still on" factor, which is like there's some shows you like you're there for a while, and then you're like, oh, okay, I'm done. And then a couple years pass, and you see an ad for it, and you're like, really? It's still, yeah, they're headed, I guess they're only a couple weeks away from the conclusion.
They're very close to, and then just yesterday I joked that TNT canceled Perception. And I was like, I mean, I joked on Twitter, I said, breaking, TNT cancels Perception. Also, there's a TV show called Perception.
Yeah, I saw that.
It was his third season.
Wow.
Yes. What, wow.
I had never heard of that show before yesterday.
I had heard of it, but I think I actually reviewed it when it came out. It was three seasons ago. You got to be like a cornerback in
what
the NFL,
that?
Jason. You got to forget. You got to forget the negativity
get
and the
to the next shit. Play. That's
yes,
right.
Move on.
Yeah. Well, Perception, was that like a monk kind of thing where there's like a detective who is very clever with perceiving? I'm just making this up, aren't I?
Well, it probably is a better show.
Oh, okay.
If you make it up that way, that's the better show.
All right.
Just perceive it to be better. Perceive it to be better than it was. How about that?
You probably used that in your review.
I probably will. I'm such a hack. I probably.
You want to do some listener feedback? Listener
Absolutely
questions?
Absolutely, listener feedback.
We do have listeners out there. And we
even when
them.
I forget to promo the entirety of the podcast.
Well, the beauty of the podcast is once you subscribe, you just get them. You don't
I know,
need
I
to tell
feel
people
like
to
it's
go
necessary
them.
To go out there and pimp it a little
well, yes,
bit.
Yes, we want to reach new listeners who want to hear us every week. So we want to grow the podcast. So it's good to promote it, but. I did hear from some people who are like, well, I did get it and listen to it. And it's like, yes, that's once you subscribed, we'll just send them to you.
And you should just say, you know what, everybody, Tim's not clear on the concept
he doesn't know
of technology and feeds and things.
That's how I do that. That's what I do. That's how I explain it all away.
I figured as much.
All right. Listener Christy wrote in. Christy in the 925, longtime listener.
Nice, Christy. Way to nail it down, the 925.
That's the Dolly Parton, the 9 to 5.
Oh, right.
Yeah, see?
It's been a long time. I forgot all of our little things.
Okay. So Lister Christie says, I'd be interested to know what you thought of the honorable woman on Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to love a good miniseries. Why aren't there more of them?
Well, that's actually, I think we're going to get more for starters, and we're going to later we're going to talk about The Missing, which is another miniseries, which is great. I loved The Honorable Woman. Right now, let's see, it's November, and I'm starting to put together my list. When I say starting, what I really mean is I haven't, but I'm mulling it. I'm ruminating on those year-end lists in my brain. Mm. And right now, in middle of November, I have not seen anything better on TV than The Honorable Woman.
Oh, look at that. So big mm-hmm. thumbs up for the Honorable Woman.
Huge thumbs up. I just loved it. It was incredibly well done, and I love the fact that it was timely and it took on a very, very hot button issue. So I mean, when you're talking about Israel and the West Bank and current affairs, it's really challenging as a writer, and they pulled it off. It's really good.
So what makes a show a miniseries? Because I've seen a lot of stuff sold as miniseries, and I'm not sure whether they're actually miniseries or they're short series. Didn't they claim like that Luther was a miniseries when it was just a season of a series?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I think miniseries may be the most abused word out there. I mean, it actually has lost all of its meaning, especially because now people are going to what, in fact, The Missing is being dubbed as a limited series. And just to be straight with everybody, a limited series is a miniseries. A miniseries is meant to be like, a miniseries was originally meant to differentiate between, okay, here's 22 episodes of a series, and then it'll come back next year. A miniseries was like, okay, here's like 8 to 11, or maybe whatever episodes, and it's kind of a season, but it's not. It's a mini season, and then it will not come back. And then that kind of morphed. So this is the year 2014 of morphing titles. So miniseries kind of morphed into anthology series, like American Horror Story, right, where you have the same title and then it's recast next year. So the same thing's going to happen with True Detective, obviously on HBO. That's now an anthology, even though it started out as a miniseries. And Fargo started out as a miniseries on FX, and that will now be an anthology series. Mm. So, but right now we have what we call event programming, meaning it's a limited series. We have limited series and we have miniseries. You know what it is? It's just a series, it's a short batch of shows that generally has a concrete conclusion. The only caveat I will throw in there is that oftentimes a limited series / miniseries is made in Europe or in the rest of the world somewhere where the tradition is shorter series anyway. But by the time that they wait until it's on the air and to see how it does to act on whether there'll be a second season, which we don't do in really this country so much. We build it to go multiple seasons and then we cancel it if it's no good. Whereas in the rest of the world, they will often, well, for example, The Returned, right? So The Returned is about to come back in its second season. But when that was first made, they had no idea there would be a second season. That's why there's kind of a resolution in the eighth episode and some cliffhangery elements to it, because it's just a different business model. A lot of times they prefer to work shorter, and I actually prefer the world to go in that direction and make shorter, tighter, brighter, and better series, whether they're mini or limited. But that's just how they do it. And then they make their decision after it's aired. Like, okay, well, you know what? Like, for example...
Broadchurch is a good example of that, right? Which was never meant to do another story or another season. And they're making a second season of it. But that was meant to be one crime, one investigation, the end, done.
That was one and done. And, you know, honestly, the British actors prefer it that way. And so do many of the British writers. They prefer... I've had this conversation before, but if you're a very creative person, what do you want to do? Do you want to write variations on your same plot and story for 22 episodes over 5 years, or do you just want to write a bunch of different things? Mm. And I think that really creative writers want to do that. And that's the way things are done in England, especially for actors. You talk to, I mean, for years I've talked to British actors and they can't even, other than making American dollars, which is a big, big motivational thing, they can't fathom the idea of 22 episodes a year for 5 years. That just, they would rather be shot in the face. It's crazy.
I guess this is one of the reasons why these anthology series exist, is that they let you keep your crew and stuff together while mm-hmm. being able to tell some different stories from year to year.
Right. And there's, you can't underestimate how important it is to actually have, once you have a hit, to have that name recognition. So American Horror Story and True Detective, those to have that name, that's a big deal. That's going to bring a lot of people back the second season. Whereas if you called it True Detective and then it ended, and then it's like guys in cars, so
from the makers of True Detective.
Yes, from the makers of, exactly.
Yeah, so why not just kind of, it's like a brand. It's like you're launching a kind of a, I don't know. I think it's smart. I think having those as mini series too is like, there are anthology shows like The Twilight Zone or something like that, where it's like week to week, you don't know what you're going to get. I like that it's a little more expansive. Like, look, we're going to tell one story over time. You're going to get 8 hours of it or whatever. And then we'll tell another story that's kind of similar from the same people. You'll probably like it because you liked the last one and just do it that way.
Yeah, and I think that's a better way. It puts a little bit of pressure on, you know, the British model puts a little more pressure on writers to put a little vagueness in the ending. You know, wrap it up, but don't wrap it up, because maybe if it's a hit, it'll come back. And for example, the series that's on BBC America right now, The Game, the spy series, the guy was very funny, Toby
Whitehouse, right?
Toby Whitehouse, right. So it's Whitehouse or Whitehouse. I can't remember. It's probably Whitehouse. Yeah. But it's he had a very funny thing. He came out and people said, well, I guess this is, you know, this is a miniseries. It's just over. It's done. And then there was a discussion about limited series. And he goes, well, I think that, you know, this could continue. It could be a renewable serial. Yeah. And so
let's not say no. If you want to give me more money, I'll.
Yeah. I mean, he wrote it to end in one season because you kind of have to. I mean, a lot of even the great British series, a lot of times they'll come out with like a really solid one season, but no one really cares. And so that's it. You'll never see it again.
I would prefer to read a novel and have it have an ending and then everybody like it and the writer to write another novel with those same characters rather than having, you know, a novel that doesn't end and says to be continued in the next book, right? I'd rather have it be self-contained, even if there's the possibility of another story with those characters later.
Exactly. I would too. I mean, the one thing you do lose is you solve a mystery, so you have to create another mystery. And then oftentimes you lose two or three of your main characters because somebody's going to die or somebody's going to be guilty or whatever. So, you know, maybe during its initial run, somebody becomes a fan favorite and they're going to say, oh, I really wish that person hadn't died. I wanted to see them in season two. But I agree. I think that the best way to do it is to keep it contained. It's better for creativity. If you keep it too vague, I think you're hedging your bets.
All right, so Lister Christie, the answer is there are actually a lot of miniseries, but you might hear them referred to as events or limited series or whatever, but they're
renewable serials.
Yes, that's exactly right, but they're out
something
there.
Something like that.
All right, listener Alan has a question about the Mike Tyson mysteries. He says,
Wait, did Alan like give us a, did he give us a zip code?
No, other information from listener Alan.
No area code.
I don't think so. He says fantastic.
I'm gonna
keep
hammering this home. Sorry, I'm going to keep hammering this home that we want the area code.
We want some identifiable angle for you. Yeah. If you don't want to give us your area code or you don't have a phone or whatever,
it's not like
we're
going to call you. Ew, we only got three of your 10 digits. Come on now, people. All right, good.
That's right. So what Mike Tyson mysteries, he says, fantastic writing, animation and music so horrible, they're great. What do you think?
Yes, I think that somebody smoked a gigantic bowl. Seriously. I mean, everybody does on Adult Swim. I mean, that's like how you come up with all your good stuff. But I mean, who thought that would have been something? Well, I mean, we'll see what the ratings are, but it's very creative. And I actually have the Mike Tyson doll that they sent with it. So maybe I'll do one of those listener parties where we throw stuff into the crowd. And that guy, who's the guy who just asked that question?
Alan,
when I have a listener appreciation party at some local place in my area code, which is the five and dime, then I'll throw it in the crowd. And if you come up, you can catch the Mike Tyson mysteries doll.
Nice.
It's awesome.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, that's a good idea. I mean, I remember ironically watching like the Mr. T cartoon and stuff like that. And, you know, it's a fun idea to do this, like with all the somebody also asked, and this is from a future. I'm going to move him up and we're going to talk about it now because listener Jake asked us a bunch of questions. And this is Jake from the 714. Ha,
nice.
See,
yes,
that's how it's Jake. Done, Alan. And one of his questions was what your take on Too Many Cooks is, speaking of Adult Swim craziness and being high.
That's a great one. From the 714?
Yeah, from the 714. That's Jake from the 714.
I believe that's
LA,
that's,
right?
That's LA, huh? I've had a 714 area code before. I okay, I'm going to say, first of all, I'm tired of hearing about that from other critics. Seriously, I'm so tired of hearing about it from everybody else that it's the end all be all, because it's like being told 1,000 times that it's the best movie you'll ever see, and then going, and they're like, yeah, it was good, but it wasn't the best ever. No, I loved it. I think that it was funny. It was creative. I wish I had come to it right at the beginning, because I probably would have had more patience for it. Because of Twitter, I was saturated by its presence, its pop culture zeitgeisty presence. But I liked it. I thought it was very funny. I thought it was way out there. what I liked more than that was follow up stories that these guys are taking meetings and they're going to make a show. I love that. Good for them. Good for them. But I caution everybody who thinks that little bit of opening TV credit bong fueled genius is going to translate into a good show. Buyer beware. I mean, I hope these guys make a ton of money, but like, just the fact that they're getting their own show does not mean your results will be very similar when they're done.
Yeah, I like the idea that Adult Swim does crazy stuff in their like infomercial time slot, and you know, they drop this in at 4 a.m. and
I thought that was that was really maybe the better part of the story. Although I think my favorite part of that is when their names are illuminated with them and they're running and she's in the closet. That was really great. That was
I mean, I think the best thing about it is that the joke keeps changing. You think you get what the joke is going to be, and that it's a parody, and then it keeps going, and you're like, oh, I see. The joke is that it goes on for a while, and then it keeps on changing, and it becomes a slasher movie. It gets more and more bizarre. The part where they're all the characters are letters, and they have people's bodies to introduce them. That was the moment. I'm like, what am I seeing here?
Yeah, that was the moment where you said, wow, they've got some good pot.
They are high.
Yeah,
right,
they're
now
so high.
Yeah,
it could not be higher.
No, that was pretty much insane. But you know, and good for them for getting. I mean, this is how you make a viral video, folks. This is TV people making something that goes viral. I'm good for them. Super catchy. I mean, that's the other thing too, is that song is exactly catchy enough to get stuck in your head.
It sure is. And I love the fact though that, I mean, the really, if you were going to dissect this and say, okay, what is the, well, there's a lot of good parts to it, but what's the true genius? The true genius was not promoting it and sticking it in the middle of the night at 4 a.m. that was the great.
That makes it a cult.
Yeah, it's like lighting a long fuse. It's like, we have this joke, you know. In some ways it was like Jimmy Kimmel when he spoofed that twerking video, and he knew all along that he was, you know, setting everybody up for the long con, and he waited forever to say, you know what, this is not a viral video. We punked you. And it was great. It was very funny.
Jake from the 714 has another couple of questions.
Okay.
He deserves that. He says, you earn a lot of cred for us for dropping the 714 in there.
Mm-hmm.
What is Tim's favorite challenge-based reality show on the air? So the reality game shows instead of the reality not game shows. Do you have a favorite?
Yeah. I think a lot of those challenge based ones are those are the ones that I watch the most. So
yeah,
whether it's a Project Runway or a Survivor, those things. I even like I kind of got hooked on the UFC where they have the women of the UFC fighting, and then it's just a super familiar setup as it goes. But I think my favorite is Amazing Race. I think I'm tired of them winning an Emmy. You know, they've won 10 straight. But it's a great show, and it's the format is great because you can travel. You get to see you get to see the world, and you see people struggle. And it's not as diabolically evil as like where the people they have to hate on each other like Survivor,
which I love. I love as a game, and there was never a reality show that I've liked more than Survivor at its peak.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, the cattiness and the knowledge that they're kind of playing characters and being bad to each other wears you down. Whereas Amazing Race, some characters will try to do that, but generally they are just, you know, they're running their own race, and whoever wins, right?
Right, and that's exactly why I think that that's the best one.
It's just less likely to hate all the characters.
It's fun, you know, and you want to root for people. You don't want to say, oh, this person's in an alliance with that person, and then you know they're going to have this buff on their head, and I'm going to hate their picture forever. But yeah, so no, I don't mind the Amazing Race because it's kind of sweet.
I also, there's a question, Jake in the 714. His last question is for me.
Oh, nice, Jason. Now,
look at that. Yes. And it's, does Jason have a guilty pleasure show on the air now? Guilty pleasure. So this is what I would say is
this one.
we're on one. Right now. I don't know if I believe in the concept of guilty pleasures. I think there are pleasures, and you shouldn't feel bad about it. But if I had to, so what I'll say is, I would say watching a show like The Flash every week is kind of a guilty pleasure, only in the sense that I'm enjoying it, but I also recognize that it is kind of junk. It's silly and fun and doesn't, you know, is not a particularly deep kind of drama, but I just enjoy it. And all the people are, I was having this conversation with Michael B. Johnson from Pixar. Do you know him,
oh, yes,
Dr. Wave?
I do, absolutely.
So I was having this conversation with him. He was like, he watched the episode where Felicity from Arrow came on, and he's like, you know, the guy running fast doesn't bother me. It's the impossibly beautiful people. Like, literally every single person on the show is impossibly beautiful. And it's stuff like that where I'm like, I recognize that it's a product geared for an audience, and it's this, you know, it's not great art, but you know what? It's fun and I like it, and it's escapism. And so I would probably list something like The Flash as a guilty pleasure. I don't feel that guilty about it, but guilty in the sense that I could be watching a piece of great art instead, and I'm not, and I'm okay with that.
But doesn't Michael know that it's the CW and it's they're mandated to be beautiful?
I think it set off that little switch. It's like, I could accept the guy who can run infinite speed, but I can't really accept they're all. Well, his point was,
and he's
I think,
a doctor.
Well, he is, and he's a computer guy. But, but, and I think that was his point, is that you've got two computer tech people, or three computer tech characters in that episode, and all of them are like super, super skinny and attractive, and they work out and all that. And I think his point was, if you're a tech person, you're sitting at typing at a desk all day, and there's no way you could look that good. But that's his take on it. I enjoyed that episode, but I admit that yes, everybody is beautiful in
and
the
yet,
world of
and
the
yet,
Flash.
One of the ironies, Michael, good looking guy.
Yeah,
good looking guy.
He may be a metahuman. Yeah, I know.
But so that's so I agree with you that like a guilty pleasure could be something like The Flash. I almost sometimes think that anything that I like on network television is a guilty pleasure because I just know it'll never reach the standards of of my favorite cable fare. And
that's true.
It's playing by different rules. So yeah. like I really like Elementary, and I like The Blacklist, and you know I'm less liking Sleepy Hollow based on our previous discussions, but. You know, those, I guess they're guilty pleasures because I can see through all the plot holes in the and the TV element. Like this, if this was a thinking man's or woman's broadcast or a cable series, it would not have done that. It would not have tried to cheat us on that little bit of realism. So they're a little bit, but I would say that what if you watched, because I used to love Alf. Wouldn't that qualify as guilty pleasure?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I find you guilty.
See, I knew you would be judgmental.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, guilty, it's right in the name. I think judgment is part of guilty pleasure.
Yes, it is.
Listener Dean wrote us a nice thing about Dexter, which I think is interesting.
Oh, yes.
And here's
Dean, way to go.
Recently, I was watching an interview with the writing team of Dexter. I Have No Life. Please don't judge. Taped during their last season, and I got a clue about why that show went so horribly wrong. The writers were talking about Dexter as if he was a hero. They seemed to really think he was a good guy, though he, killed people, but only the right people, you know, which is just insane. David Chase did not make that mistake. He knew Tony was a bad guy who did evil things. In the last few years, there have been a lot of anti-heroes on TV. Obviously, you can't make a charmless, murdering oaf the center of a show and expect people to keep watching. But which shows have best balanced featuring an anti-hero as the lead and yet keeping the show itself on an even moral keel, and which haven't? And I think this is a great, thank you, Dean. That's a great question. And I think he nailed one of the big problems with Dexter, which is like, yay, we love Dexter. No, he's a killer. You can't do that. So what do you think? Shows that have best balanced, like, you've got your anti-hero lead and yet you still keep a moral center.
Yeah, I think I think when Showtime started referring to him as America's favorite serial killer, we knew they were on the wrong track. But yeah, no, that is a great question, and it totally nails exactly why Dexter ended up and going off the rails and becoming a crappy ass show, which it did. I mean, it had a chance to be a great show, and then it became a crappy ass show where, you know, he's a lumberjack. So, spoiler.
So who does it right? I mean, Sopranos is a good example of that. Is Breaking Bad a good example of that, you think?
I think when you look at some of the – when you look at the top-end cable shows we're talking about where you take somebody who – well, yeah, Tony is – I think the – Tony Soprano is kind of – I think he would have to go into the dictionary as like this is how you do it. This is the template for all other anti-heroes. And, you know, variations of that have come and gone. You know, like there's been Al Swearengen from Deadwood, and there's been various ones. But I think that Walter White and Breaking Bad is the ultimate, because no one's ever done this. I mean, let's just to be clear, no one has ever done what Vince Gilligan did and set out to do, which is, I mean, he said it many times. When he first said it in the second season, no one knew what he was talking about. But when he said, I'm going to take Mr. Chips and turn him into Scarface, that was something that had never been done to that level on television. And I don't know if we're ever going to see that again, because you're taking your first season of Breaking Bad. I mean, Walter is the person you are rooting for. Mm-hmm. And he ends up, you know, on the opposite side. You're actually wanting... At some point, you're wanting him to die. And that's like on paper, whether people react that way or not. I mean, some people are going to see Walter as somebody who should never have, you know, should not die, or he's not a bad person. He just made a couple of mistakes. But the creators want you to know, no, he's a bad person. He's really bad. And David Chase was, in particular, vehement that people misunderstood Tony. And in the third season of Sopranos, if you go back, he really ratcheted up. He told critics, I actually was one of the people who was asking this question before the third season, and he had said, and I just sort of set him up to go on a soapbox about how Americans were misinterpreting Tony's likability. And the short answer of that is he's not supposed to be likable. And that in the third season, he ratcheted it up so that Tony was a little bit more despicable, actually a lot more despicable in the third season, so that those lines would be a little bit more clearly drawn. But I think what David Chase and Vince Gilligan and others have found out is that no matter how bad you make a character, some people are just going to think, you know what, he's redeemable. It's just so you can't like really think, oh, the audience is going to be right on my side, that this is exactly how we should feel about them, because they're not. They're going to have their own impressions. And then that's just, you know, that's just the nature of, you know, human beings.
And we're trained also as viewers of movies and TV shows to try to identify with and root for the lead, right? And the really good shows with an anti-hero play on that and lead you down. I mean, that's the idea of Breaking Bad, right? Is that you're leading people down a path to the point where the character is irredeemable. And the question in the audience's mind is, at what point in the last 7 years did I flip over? What was that like? What made me think, oh no, this guy's, he's gone too far? And that plays on your, you know, your expectation that you're going to be rooting for this person, which is why it's clever. But some people never get out of that, I think. They're like, no, Tony Soprano, I love him.
Yeah, and it definitely frustrates, you know, in some ways, that's one of the things that I've, you know, love about covering television, getting to know people who make it, is that their reactions to what happens when they put these characters into the world is kind of fascinating. You know, like you can't predict how people will react, as the story about David Chase illustrates. But I think I love how that not knowing can frustrate them. And it's almost like, I always kind of go back to this analogy. It's like so many times in music, a really great lyricist will write a song, and it will be about a thing, And then literally 80% of the people will think it's about something else. And it's out of their hands at that point. People will make of it what they will. And yeah, I just think that you can't control people. And I think the thing that really frustrated Vince Gilligan at one point was this feeling that people were hating Skyler, his wife, more than hating Walter White. And that freaked him out. I think that, you know, as somebody who creates television, he was like, wait, they hate Skyler more than they hate Walter White. What happened?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I remember when Ronald Reagan quoted Born in the USA, and Bruce Springsteen was like, wait. This is about America mistreating Vietnam veterans. And like, no, it's yay, USA, USA. Like, no. Right.
Oh!
One more piece of a listener feedback. It's listener Kate who was asking, what does Jason think of this season's run of Doctor Who now that it's over?
Oh, nice. Yes.
A little time.
I so want to hear. Thank you, Kate. I wish you would have put your area code in there. But yeah. Yes, thank you, Kate. That's a great question.
So my forward promotion statement will be that next week's episode of The Incomparable will cover this as a panel. So you can tune in for probably 90 minutes of us arguing about it. My short version would be, and I think this is not the answer she wanted to hear, because she said, is the golden age of Doctor Who over? Is what she asked.
Right? She tipped her hand there.
So what I'd say is, I didn't love the finale. I thought the finale was a little bit silly. I thought it was actually emotionally solid, and I think it read to me like Stephen Moffat wanted the season long themes and the character arcs to have a really good climax and resolution, and that happened, and then he built a kind of ridiculous over the top season finale plot, the kind of thing you want to end your season on, with lots of shooting and robots and stuff, and that sort of didn't make any sense, but that the emotional truth was there, which I thought was effective. I think Peter Capaldi is fantastic and elevated some of the weaker material, but I gotta say, and this I think in fan circles this may be a kind of crazy statement, but I think this was overall, with a few weaker episodes in there because that happens, overall I think this was the best season Doctor Who has done since it came back. I felt last
Whoa,
year I thought
that's
last
a big statement.
I thought
Even
last year was pretty weak.
Nothing about it, that's a big
I thought last year was pretty weak, and if you filed off all of the credits and stuff and just put the two seasons in front of me, I would be completely convinced that this was a new showrunner running. It's like a totally different show. And so full credit to Stephen Moffat for taking the show and really rethinking of what Doctor Who can be in a way that nobody's really done since it came back in 2005. And you can like it or dislike it, but I love that they're trying something totally different. 8 seasons into this reboot, they're trying to really change the kinds of stories they tell. There's a much more, like, there are a few episodes that felt like fairy tales or fables, and some harder sci-fi fans hate that. But I thought it was – I love the degree of difficulty. I love the ambition. And I think they succeeded more often than they failed. And then you got Peter Capaldi, who is fantastic. And he owned it. He totally owned it. Like, they could have done a season worth of bad scripts and it would have been worth watching. And I don't think it was a season worth – I think it was actually a season of really interesting, challenging scripts and stories. So – that's my take.
This is really interesting, especially from somebody who, as you know, I'm well documented that I don't put my toe into the Doctor Who world.
You've got a Doctor Who mug and gave it to me.
Yes, yes.
That's how into it you are.
Yes, and those were not
collector's edition. Yeah,
yeah. Because at that point, I'm not sure if they changed, but they were not available in the U.S.
Oh yeah,
so.
I know. I think about that every time I drink tea out of it, mm-hmm.
out of the TARDIS.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had to go get the right one. I had to find the right one.
No, you nailed it.
The somebody who I'm fascinated by it, but I can't really put a critical spin on it because I'm not involved in it. But to me, I guess that is the downside of being in that position where you can't sort of get into it. Like, okay, new Doctor and like a new series, and how is it going? So what I've just picked up from Twitter and the zeitgeist about Doctor Who was that it was a really kind of controversial season. But what you're saying is it's one of the best ones since it's come back.
I totally understand why it's controversial and polarizing. Like I said, it worked for me much more often than it didn't. but I totally see why it's polarizing, because they did it is like I said, it is very different from the show was even last year, and mm-hmm. they're trying to shake things up. And how many shows go into their eighth season, let alone whatever 51st year,
right.
trying to redefine what the show is and really like question like what kind of stories are we trying to tell? And I thought this year's Doctor Who actually did that. I felt like, you know, last year especially, but the show's kind of lazy. It fell into a rut. It's like, and there's still some laziness from time to time. I think the season finale was a little bit lazy, but overall, I felt like there was a much bigger commitment to, like, the dialogue was better and the character arcs were better, and it had some more adult kind of themes of what it means, you know, asking what the Doctor's role is as somebody who's kind of bringing other people on these adventures and giving orders and sending people to their deaths. And there were a lot more deaths this season. It was a little bit less of the light romp where everybody's not really in danger, everybody's going to be okay at the end. There were some more actual like character deaths that were upsetting, and I get why people might not like it. Like I said, polarizing, not surprising at all that it's polarizing. It worked for me. I think I'd much rather see a show try difficult stuff and to change and to do interesting things, even if it fails, which I think it succeeded more often than it failed this year. But even if it failed, I think that's way more interesting than just being lazy and saying, here's an eighth helping of that thing you've already had seven helpings of, right?
Exactly, exactly. Well, I guess people who are super interested in the Doctor Who franchise need to listen to The Incomparable.
Yeah, they should listen to next week's Incomparable. And we also did on also on the Incomparable Network, we did there's a podcast called TV that's got episode by episode recap reviews of every episode of Doctor Who this season, and actually every episode of Sons of Anarchy this season is over there. So if you're a fan,
well, they could catch up on that. Mm-hmm.
They could. You can listen to that.
Not that we would pimp out another TV.
No.
You know.
Well, we did plug. Podcast. I think we plugged TV Talk Machine on last week's Incomparable.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, it all goes.
All right.
It's a network effect. Oh, anyway, crossover. Listener
we're
Kate.
A bunch of whores. We're a pack of whores.
Listener Kate, thank you for your.
Yes, Kate, thank you.
Asking me about Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A few more. I've got on my little agenda here some things you wrote about at the Hollywood Reporter this week.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That are in the, you know, they're current. They're in the present day state of affairs. Everybody's America's sweetheart, Catherine Heigl is back on TV.
Hmm.
I think at least temporarily.
Temporarily, I would think that's the addition you want to make.
So this is not now. Let me ask you this. I thought this show was already on, but it turns out that's a different show where Taya Leone is the Secretary of State.
Adam's Secretary.
So what? So is Catherine Heigl not the Secretary of State? What's her job?
She is not.
What show is this? I've gotten these shows horribly.
What are we watching?
I've gotten these shows horribly confused, and I thought all the shows had already been on, but this show is just coming on. So what's the deal? State of affairs.
And the crazy part is not until the 17th, right? It's like already, like it's gonna be Christmas before the show comes on.
That's right. The first episode, she's cooking a turkey.
Well, like I pointed out, like, look, I think you have to. I mean, whether it's good or not, I mean, is one thing. But I think that with the one that I approach, my approach to criticism is to have a little bit of. Industry analysis wove into it.
Right. And, why is this? All these shows are a combination of art and commerce, right? So why does this show exist, and why is it?
Yeah, and there's got to be a backstory to it. And the two things that stood out to me are it is literally, I believe, the last what you could call fall. I don't think anybody else in the rest of the country would call it fall. Because they're in snow.
But in LA, you could do it.
But in LA, it's a fall show. Yeah. But November 17th, man, that is really late.
Yeah.
That is very late. So why do you – there's a couple of theories, and I will get to the crunch of State of Affairs. But there's a couple of theories is like you put your best shows on in the fall because that's when people watch. Other people say, you know what? We're going to put 40 shows out there. And we know we're doing it, and we can't change the formula, but wink, 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 come January in our mid-season, when everybody, all these shows die down and you have more choices and you're more open to discovery, then we're going to drop our really super special show in mid-season. So there's a couple of those theories, but there is no theory that involves running a show on November 17th, because now you're stuck in between two seasons. So what's NBC thinking here? Did they believe in it or did they not believe in it? And the other thing that's very worrisome to me, and I wrote in the review that went online today. well, it went online on Friday.
Yes, as we record this today.
As we record this, that they had a very long time to give us extra episodes, and they didn't. When you have a show this late, you should be able to give us the entire season. You know, we should have 6 or 8 episodes completely shot by now, or more. And they didn't. They left us with a pilot, and as I pointed out in my review, a pilot with zero buzz. I mean, you didn't even know what show it was.
I thought it was that other show.
Yeah, and as I pointed out there too, CBS has already beaten you to the punch with the powerful woman running the country kind of thing. So she's, you know, Tia Leone is the more Hillary-esque of the characters, but also Katherine Heigl in State of Affairs has been lumped into, is she kind of a Hillary Clinton person? She's actually a CIA analyst.
All right.
Who gives the president her daily briefing. And she runs a team of analysts who spend all night combing the world for hotspots, which they will tell the president about in the morning.
So it's like a Zero Dark 30 kind of...
Exactly.
Cross with the West Wing. I don't know.
With a star vehicle curse, which is, you know, the curse of the star vehicle is that because it's Katherine Heigl and it's her return to television, and really it's because she accepted the show because it's going to be a star vehicle about her, then everything else is secondary, including, hilariously to me, the fact that Alfre Woodard, who, by the way, is a fantastic actress.
Yes.
And who, by the way, plays the president in this show. So you know it's a star vehicle when Alfre Woodard as the president barely gets any screen time in the pilot. So this is really about Katherine Heigl. And unfortunately, it's not very good. Though we only got one pilot. I mean, one episode of the pilot. There is no buzz. It doesn't make a lot of sense. It has a twisty element to it that makes you think at the end, okay, maybe I'll care about that, but I don't see myself caring about that little twist for more than one season if this has longevity to it. And for me, because I'm hung up on small, petty, funny stuff, they call her character Charleston Tucker. And I just burst out laughing the very first time they called. She goes, now Charleston. So I'm like, wow, why would you pick that name? That is the worst. In fact, today I tweeted out that if it was Punxsutawney, it would be less cumbersome and annoying than Charleston. So it scans
Katherine Heigl Charleston Tucker. They actually scan. They're the same syllable count as her name.
Maybe that's it.
Maybe she just responds to a series of syllables like a dog whistle or something. Just like, you know what?
Oh. Charleston. Look. We have to do a whole separate TV talk machine on names, character names. Because I think people who read books will love that discussion, because sometimes you just can't get past a character name. You know, it's like, oh, really? Your name's this, which, you know, it references what you do for a living, blah, blah. But Charleston, that is so clunky and so trite. It's just like, oh, okay, Charleston Tucker, and then she's Charlie for a long time. Hey, Charlie Tucker. Okay, well, or whatever. But don't call her Charleston, because that just makes me want to shoot the TV.
So not a good show is what you're saying.
Well, I was probably irritated by the rest of it when I got to that point where I wanted to shoot the TV about her name. I was annoyed by the rest of it being not very well done.
What about The Missing?
That I love. And that's, again, a limited series.
That's on Starz, is that right?
That's on Starz. You know, technically, it was bought by Starz.
It's a BBC.
It's BBC. So it's high quality. It is limited series. It's closed-ended. I do not think that was going to come back. But it's great. You can actually watch the very first episode. If you don't get Starz, you can watch the very first episode on Starz.com right now and find out whether that's something you're going to want to revisit when it comes out in DVD form or when it can be streamable or rentable. And I think you should do that. It's really great. It is like Broadchurch. I compared it very favorably to Broadchurch because it is about, in this case, a kidnapped disappearance of a young boy. Broadchurch is the killing of a young boy. And in Missing, the mystery is the boy alive or dead? And it's very, very hard to watch if you're a parent. But at the same time, it's exceptionally well done, to the point where it proves that, well, like, why would you ever try to remake Broadchurch as Grace Point? You know, it's like my point was like, okay, the two brothers who wrote Missing, Broadchurch was already out. So they didn't actually just say, oh, geez, somebody did a thing about a boy who dies, so we can't do that. Let's just remake it. No, they said, you know what? We have a story that's different, and we can write it, and it'll be great in and of itself separately from Broadchurch. And they did just that. And It's really strong. There's incredible acting all the way through. James Nesbitt and Francis O'Connor. I mean, James Nesbitt is amazing in this. Really great. So watch that.
So, this brings up the issue of just watching. Some stuff is, some TV shows are tough. Some stuff is harder to watch, and you see it on your TiVo and you're like, oh, can I really stomach that right now? Am I really into it? And this is one of those examples that I know, you know, parents watching shows about missing or dead kids or kids in jeopardy can be really difficult. And there have been a bunch of them lately.
There have been. And I think that, you know, I used to have a whole like children in peril philosophy of like, you know what? I'm never going to watch that. I just can't. It's just going to hit too close to home. And, I remember that a friend of mine, Oscar Villon, who was at the time he was the book critic and book editor at the Chronicle when, The Road came out from Cormac McCarthy. And he's like, don't read this book. He's like, you have a young boy, don't read this book. And, later, of course, I actually watched the movie. And when I finished watching the movie, I was like, why did I watch that movie? You know, it was very difficult to get through. There was nothing that was redeeming about it.
Yeah, I haven't seen the movie, but I'll tell you the book. I like that book because to me it was a book about a father's love of a son, a parent's love of their child, that they would literally do anything,
right,
and everything to protect their child, even if they were doomed. I like that part of it, but yeah, super depressing.
Yeah, and I think when you see it visualized and the bleakness comes to life. I mean, I didn't read the book, but people will say the book's better than the movie, but the movie is really just incredibly depressing.
Yeah. Well, the book is too.
Never veers off that depressing note.
Everything's bad. Everyone's going to die.
And nothing, there is no redemption in the end. And I love Cormac McCarthy's worldview along that line anyway. I'm kind of drawn to that, but my feeling is, okay, I get it. Intellectually, I get the fact that you don't want to watch something that's going to make you think that one of your kids is in the world is a scarier place than you even want to admit to yourself. But I think when it's done extremely well and not exploitative, which I think a lot of network shows, ironically, this lower level quality, they put kids in peril and in these awful situations where you don't want to see it because they just handle it badly. But I think that if something like Broadchurch and The Missing, it stands out because intellectually and emotionally they understand the timeline of the grief and the fallout and then the residual impact of seeing like a picture someone drew 10 years ago, et cetera, et cetera. They really get it and they take the time to make it powerful. But I think at the same time, it's just a really excellent story, well told, so that from an artistic standpoint, you should watch it because it's a really good piece of television.
I totally get as a parent, you know, mm-hmm. I totally get the reluctance to watch a show about something horrible happening to a child. I have a much bigger problem with a show that cheaply uses child peril to amp up the drama than I do about a show that's fundamentally like unflinchingly about the impact. Like Broadchurch. Broadchurch does not hide from the fact that there's a family whose son is or brother, whatever, the boy in their family is found dead on the beach, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't hide from that and how that tears that whole community apart, which it's hard stuff to watch, but it doesn't feel cheap to me. And that oftentimes you'll see like in movies or TV shows, there'll be like a kid being held by a bad guy and you know, the bad guy's got a gun and there's a kid and they're like, watch out or I'll kill this kid. And it feels so lazy and like, you know, oh, this will be shocking. People will be upset because I'm going to threaten a kid. And that's what offends me actually is the lazy way out. Not like actually exploring how horrible it would be if something terrible happened to a child. Right.
Absolutely. I think that anytime you use it in a manipulative way, it's far worse than actually just a graphically realistic depiction of evil in the world or things that can go bad. And even to the point where I think your examples are sound. I think even when you do something like Fox is doing with the Red Band Society, that I find that manipulative. It's like sick kids but they're going to be cool, but they're also in a coma and they've got cancer and they're going to die and all this. You know, it's like, you know what? Forget it. You're just trying to you're trying to pull my heartstrings right. or make me sad in some manipulative way, and I'm not going to go for
They're sick in only the ways that we tell you, and you know the reality of them being sick isn't no. They look good. They're doing great.
They are doing great. They look like they're on vacation.
Yeah, well, that's because the hospital in that show is a dorm.
It is a dorm. It would never be like a real children's hospital. No.
They would go bankrupt.
Yes, exactly.
If that's how hospitals worked. We were almost out of time. I have one other topic, which was just, you know, I know you covered the newsroom at the Hollywood Reporter. Newsroom mm-hmm. came back. And I think we might have briefly talked about it last week. I watched the first few episodes and just couldn't even get through it because it was so... I mean, it was Sorkin-y on one level, but it just was so like preachy and overwrought, and I don't know, I couldn't do it. And remind me, your feeling about the newsroom is, you know, cool. Are you cool on it?
No, I don't like it.
Yeah, okay,
so
good.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I tried to give in my review of it because Sorkin kind of announced, and he's sort of said it many times, but he basically said, "I'm not going to do TV again."
Yeah,
and I actually think he should not do. I mean, at some point, I think he has another great TV show in him somewhere. I think The West Wing and Sportsnet were both great for a very long time.
You know what it should be, Tim?
Mm.
It should be a mini series.
It should be a limited series.
Right? Why not? HBO signs Aaron Sorkin up. He's got a good idea. It's not really a movie idea. Sign him up to do 7 hours of it and then go away, right?
And
not commit to like seasons of this, because that's – I mean I brought this up because I wanted to talk about like what you think good Sorkin is. But, you know, like Sports Night's a good example. I love Sports Night, but I really only love the first season of Sports Night. And the second season, it was already, it felt to me, like spinning out of control. And The West
yeah.
Wing, similarly, started really strong. And then time kind of kept going, and it kind of spun out of Aaron. People always talk about it like getting worse when Sorkin left. I feel like it got worse before he left, and then stayed worse for a while after
Oh, it
he
did
left.
Get worse before he left.
Yeah.
And I think the part of the problem, and it's hard to say this about somebody's talents, is that he's much better in the movie and play world, right? He's a playwright. To do those, he's better because he's 2 hours and you're out.
Yeah, yeah.
But to watch countless hours of Aaron Sorkin being Aaron Sorkin, so these Sorkinisms of the walking and talking and the rapid fire delivery where every single person talks just like each other.
Yeah.
There's no variation in it. He does not write women very well. His characters mm-hmm. of women are really poorly done. He's not very funny. He can be clever. He's not funny. There's a huge difference. And he doesn't understand that part. And then the other thing that drives me crazy is that one of his worst, the trait that he is most known for when he gets it right is also the trait that he's most known for getting wrong. And the more hours you put of television out, the more you're gonna get it wrong. And that is, he is a total soapboxer.
Yeah.
He cannot resist doing a monologue about something and being preachy about it. And you just cannot have that level of soapboxing over and over and over again without becoming completely annoyed with it and wanting to kill him. So there's that.
Yeah. I'm
the character, I'm not Sorkin, but yeah, each character that's doing the soapboxing, you're like, okay, shut up already. We get it.
It's like, I think we're in agreement here that he's an incredibly talented writer, but there are things he's more adept at, and that, dwelling too long in one place is not good for him or his work, I think. And so
Exactly. Better,
I would love to see him back on TV at some point, but like I said, I think miniseries is the way to go. I think like literally give him a certain, what's your story? What do you want to tell? How long is it? Okay, we're in business with you now, and then we will go away, and that'll be it. That's going to work for him at a level. You can write the whole thing. Everybody can look at it and say, yep, this looks good. This is the whole thing. Go make it. Instead of, you know, this commitment by a guy who really shouldn't be committed over the long haul to a story or characters, because it all starts to fall apart with him.
And that's how, you know, wrapping this up in our theory of limited series and miniseries,
yeah,
event programming and anthologies, I think you could actually bring all the people who used to like Sorkin and now don't, or didn't kind of and now hate him. I think you could actually resell it by saying, in a limited series,
yeah,
Aaron Sorkin, 7 episodes only. We will not annoy you beyond that. You know, it's just like, you can almost sell it. You can almost like package it and say, okay, if you really like this guy's good qualities, and we know what his bad qualities are. Don't worry about that. He's only on for 7 hours, so come see it. Yeah, I think you've got something there. I think that'll work.
I think Studio 60, as an example, which was a really great pilot and a really bad series, would have benefited if somebody had said, okay, Aaron, here's what we're going to do, is you're only going to get 8 of these. Tell a story. Tell a story with these characters. Where are they going? Are they going to take over the show? Is it going to be a flop? Give us an arc, and then that's the end. Then the show would have had a shape, and it might have actually been something instead of sort of being nothing, because it was going to go on forever until it got canceled, right? I think that would always, in almost any scenario, work better for Aaron Sorkin to say, tell us a story, and then be done and go tell another story.
Do you think that when Aaron Sorkin goes to a party, people say, give me the short version?
I think they look around and make sure that they haven't left their soapbox out somewhere.
When they're looking up at him, they know that they're in trouble. Oh, look at him. He's up on that box again. Damn it.
Yep. Never fails. Aaron's on the box again. All right. Well, Tim, we've reached the end again. A successful episode 9, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of good stuff.
Our 9mm. It's our Glock episode.
Okay. Fair enough. And we've got, I don't know. We haven't sold this as a miniseries. So, you know, we'll be back next week with number 10. And it just goes on and on and on. And who knows where it ends. So anyway, thank you very much for being on this week. Pleasure.
Well, I'm happy to be on and not do work, since I'm supposed to be the host. I love that. I'm just going to be on my own show.
I'm your facilitator.
Yes, you are you're working the knobs. You are the magic man.
so we should specify. Yeah, I'm manning the knobs here. I gotta specify ways to reach us, since we are so driven by the questions from the listeners out there. Also, if you want to give us some hint of where you are, whether it's an area code or something else, you can tweet to @TVTM. I'm Jay Snell on Twitter. Tim is Bastard Machine on Twitter. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/TV Talk Machine. And you can send us email at podcast@TVTalkMachine.com. So there's lots of ways to reach us. And until next time, thank you for listening to the TV Talk Machine. See you next week.